I would honestly say to you that I don't think there's a single driver in any of our teams that I've worked with over God knows how many years and how many drivers that I haven't had a fairly major falling out with at some point in time. Because, we're, you know, quite frankly, being honest with drivers is another thing you have to be. You can't fiddle around the edges. If there's some complete mess, then they've got to be told and they've got to be held to account. They're part of a team.
Hello and welcome to James Allen on F1 Podcast, brought to you by Autosport. Now, this week, we're going to look at why it's so tricky to build a winning team in Formula One and why success is never guaranteed. We'll look behind the scenes at Adrian Newey's big money move to Aston Martin and ask what that means for the competitive picture in the next 5 years of Formula One. And we'll hear from a celebrated manager, David Richards, who took BAR Honda to second place in the World Championship behind Michael Schumacher's mighty Ferrari team 20 years ago. Well, I'm joined in the studio today by our very own Autosport F1 editor, John Noble. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Very bright and breezy this morning. Yeah.
Well, I've tried to. Long day yesterday with an Adrian Newey announcement. I went to the England football game last night. So very long day of lots of driving, but back at it this morning.
A glutton for punishment. And chief F1 writer Ben Hunt, good to see you.
Yeah, thanks, James. Yeah, similar to John. Yeah, I was up there yesterday with Adrian Newey, and then last night went go-karting with my son, which was excellent fun.
Was he quicker than you?
Yes.
Slight weight advantage, possibly.
Yeah, I did too, right. Yeah, especially at the moment. But he was doing good.
So as you mentioned, you were both at the swanky new headquarters of Aston Martin at Silverstone yesterday for that Adrian Newey announcement. I mean, first of all, what was the vibe like, and what was the moment in F1 history that you would compare this to? I mean, I'm scratching my head to think of something comparable, especially when it comes to an engineer. Driver moves maybe, but even an engineer, I can't think of anything like this.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I was thinking. I was driving there and I put it in my piece on Autosport. You know, for me, it felt like when Real Madrid used to unveil their latest signing, you know, they used to do it at the Bernabeu Stadium, and all the fans would be there, and you'd have like 80,000 fans watching a new signing who would have cost a lot of money, you know, doing keepy-uppies on the pitch. And, you know, it was very much a showcase, but I can't actually remember that for, you know, a technical member of staff. You know, it was curious, the timing, because, you know, let's still remember that he is a Red Bull employee. You know, I don't know how they would feel about it. You know, the fact that they're still paying his wages up until March, you know, that he was at another factory, stood in front of this Aston Martin logo and everything else, and, you know, gushing about, you know, how he can't wait to join them. It was quite intriguing. But I think the biggest thing for me is the positive uplift it gives everyone in that team. Yes, they've seen lots of faces come in, but this is the marquee signing that can sort of, you know, give them that extra boost. And I'm not talking about the big names, but it's the people who are working the long hours, you know, the ones that we don't know. And he can, you know, just his presence there can give everyone a boost just to dig a little bit deeper, to work a bit harder. And that's exactly what Aston Martin need at the moment.
To me, I mean, it felt like it's almost the move that should have happened back in 2001. If we recall, go all the way back then when Newey signed, remember he signed for Jaguar, and that I remember chasing that story in the Monaco paddock, and, you know, I asked Bobby Rahal, who was team boss at the time, you know, have you signed Adrian Newey? And he just kept going, no comment, no comment. And I was trying to get led away by kind of Jaguar PR people, and it was crystal clear something was happening, and it had happened. He had signed. And there was this amazing 4 days where, you know, Jaguar had him and he was all going there. And suddenly there was the massive U-turn, and Ron Dennis kind of pulled some heartstrings and got him to agree to stay there. So I think in terms of seismic thing, had he gone to Jaguar at the time, I think it would have been as big as this is now. But this is a deal that's happened. And it's also happened we're in this era of social media and, you know, video blogging of everything and TikTok and videos everywhere. So I think it's just a different era. So I think when these announcements come, the Jaguar announcement that I think was actually put out briefly for 10 minutes in 2001 was, you know, simple facts back at those time. Now, you know, everything's broadcast in a very different way. But I think equally seismic, because I think this is the, you know, a step that will influence the World Championship battle going forwards.
Yeah, well, we'll come on to that in a moment. But staying with you, John, I mean, there is no doubting Lawrence Stroll's, the boss's, bold vision, his willingness to back his instincts with hard cash. You know, you can't fault him for that. He's got these world-class facilities and he's brought in all the people that knew he is going to be working with to try and build this. But success in Formula One is never guaranteed. I mean, how do you see this changing the competitive picture in F1 over the next 5 years?
I think what Newey has is this ability to kind of be a glue that can stick a winning team together. I don't think, you know, there's not one individual who's going to turn a team that's not winning races into world champions. There's probably not one individual who can help make it, you know, elevate it big steps. But what Newey does do is he gets the best out of everybody there. And I think that's why it was a big success at Red Bull. I spoke to Dan Fellows yesterday, who's technical director at Aston Martin, just talking about the strengths that Newey can bring, because he's worked with him at Red Bull, he's going to work with him at Aston Martin. And he just talked about this insane competitiveness and this ability to kind of float around and focus in on the key areas where he feels he can make a difference. So if it's underfloor aerodynamics, if it's suspension settings, if it's, you know, DRS, if it's, you know, an area of car that's underperforming, Newey hones in on it and digs deep and, you know, has all these amazing ideas on how to improve things. And he chases things down to these smallest details. He talked about, you know, reports will come in from junior engineers on, you know, a car component and a theoretical element of competitiveness, which normally in many other teams will get floated up the system and disappear into the ether and not get chased. But Newey will read everything. And if he wants to question something, either because he doesn't believe in it or thinks, oh, actually, that's a better idea, he'll turn up at this junior engineer's desk, bang on their desk and stand over them and ask questions. And it infuses them. He's engaged in it all and he bounces ideas off people. And he also hasn't got this arrogance to think that he alone has all the best ideas. Because at the end of the day, the best ideas all come together to produce the best racing car. And that's all Adrian cares about. He wants to help produce the best racing car.
It was very interesting for me. I mean, you two were there, obviously. I watched it on TV, and it's always interesting watching people you know really well and looking at the body language and looking at the way that they express themselves. And what struck me about Newey yesterday was, first of all, that sort of steely determination in his eye. And he actually gave a lot away about his feelings, about his motivations. I thought he expressed himself extremely well. But you could tell that he absolutely means business. I mean, I love the way he was talking about that he's going to be there every day. And then he said, at least to begin with, you know, which everyone was thinking, oh yeah, he's going to be sort of phoning it in from Cape Town and he's going to be designing the car sort of, you know, thousands of miles away on his yacht. But clearly to start with, he's going to be in there and he's going to be driving this thing to get them to where they need to be. And then we'll see how it goes from there once they've kind of reached that level. And, you know, he's a humble man. People would think he's an egomaniac, but he isn't. Mm. And he doesn't like egomaniacs. He likes to work in a harmonious team setting. And he kept on going on about the creative environment. You almost felt as though Stroll had kind of built this thing first, you know, knowing that he wanted Newey to sort of fit in with it. And he made some sort of disparaging comments about other places he's worked, clearly the McLaren, where Ron Dennis built this sort of bunker and shoved all the creative people underground and what have you. So I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. And he clearly means business. He obviously loves working with Honda. He believes they're going to have a good engine for 2026. But I mean, there's no doubt then, Ben, that Stroll is now going to be turning his attention to drivers. You know, I hope so,
James, because I think this is the thing, isn't it? Go on, I'll let you carry on.
But, well, no, I was just going to say his son, Lance, is going to have a car capable of winning the world championship that his father believes that he's capable of winning in a couple of years' time. So who does Lawrence put alongside him to guarantee success? Because Alonso, you know, it was great to hear him talk about Newey and he spoke very well, but realistically at 45, he isn't going to be the guy who's going to deliver that championship for Aston Martin. Fabulous driver though he is. And he's got his timing a bit wrong. If he was maybe 6 years younger or something, you could really believe it. But what do you think happens here? How do you see this, Ben?
This is an uncomfortable one, isn't it, for Lawrence? You know, I think that he's got to be ruthless and realize perhaps that his son isn't going to be the world champion that he hopes him to be, based on what we've seen so far. You know, maybe, I mean, people tell me that, you know, Lance is under a lot of pressure. I mean, I always talk about body language, I always, you know, fascinated by his body language when he's in the press conference. Clearly doesn't look like he's there, happy to be there. Starts these questions about, you know, do you really want to be in Formula One? And then there was all these rumors about him quitting to start tennis and whatever else. You know, he's under a lot of pressure to fulfill not only his own expectations, but also the expectations of his dad. It's massive, massive pressure. By signing Adrian, you know, on one hand, it's great because he's got this potential for this wonderful car design, but that only serves to increase the pressure on him. There's now no hiding place. You know, there's no, you know, there's no wriggle room for him. He's got to start delivering. If he doesn't, then, as I say, it's an uncomfortable decision for Lawrence to make. You know, if you're serious about plucking the best engineers, best partners and everything else, and, you know, have that wonderful factory, it's no good if you've got drivers that can't win you races. And unfortunately, as I say, at the moment, based on what we see of Lance, he's just not got that ability, which means that if he doesn't improve, then obviously Lawrence has got to make that hard decision to maybe replace his son. You know, how does he go about doing that? I don't know. But, you know, he's been ruthless in business. He's there to win. He's telling us he wants to win. If he's got all the right ingredients, then he needs to be able to put that together and they need to deliver on track. And if the weakness is a driver, then obviously he's got to address that.
Well, we'll come back to drivers in a second, but John, the other thing that was really intriguing for me, and I know a lot of listeners will be wondering how watertight the rules are around quote-unquote gardening leave, and particularly Newey's gardening leave. Roberto Quinquero, our colleague, has written a great piece on Autosport today, which is all about how many people end up on gardening leave and how sort of ridiculously long these periods can be and how what a blocker it is to kind of people moving between teams. But in the case of Newey, I think it's quite a significant. So it could end up with quite a row, I think, because it seems that the 2026 chassis regulations are going to come out at the very beginning of next year. And then Newey is joining Aston Martin on the 1st of March. So you've got a shortfall there. And he says him and his wife Amanda are going to be out and about, you know, on their yacht somewhere or, you know, taking some time off. But how can anyone monitor, especially in the era of remote working and all the rest of it, how can anyone monitor his input or that he isn't making any input into that critical early design phase of the Aston Martin, you know, long before he sets his foot in the building?
Well, you can't these days, can you? I mean, it was noticeable yesterday because we were in there was a little room set up upstairs in the building two it was, for the media to work in. And you could see kind of the chiefs wandering around. At one point, Stroll walked past with Andy Cowell, with Adrian Newey, Dan Fellows following them, so obviously wandering around. And in the old days of gardening leave, you'd be, as Adrian Newey well knew from McLaren, you know, marched out of the factory. Same at Red Bull, told one day, okay, out your office, you're gone. So you were taken out of the one factory and you weren't allowed back in weren't allowed into another one. And that would, in the old days, would limit your input into what's going on. But these days, I mean, to have Newey, you know, wandering around the factory, you'd be guaranteed he will have been giving them some pointers on the car and concepts and chats. And it only takes a 5-minute conversation on some concept. And that's enough information to help, which isn't a breach of any IP. He's not taking secrets. It's just downloading his knowledge of what makes a successful car. And if he goes sailing, you know, if they're disappearing sailing for the winter somewhere or do something, you know, January the 1st or 2nd, the new 26 regulations come out. What's to stop him thinking, creating, coming up with ideas, discussing stuff? Even if there's no formal transfer of IP across to Aston Martin, you can be guaranteed on when he walks into that Aston Martin factory officially on March the 1st next year, his notebook's not going to be empty. It's going to be crammed full of ideas and concepts and information ready to hit the ground running. He's not going to be playing 2 months of catch up.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if he is indeed away, Adrian works analog. Should we call it analog? You know, pen and paper. You know, he's drawing all the time. You know, we were talking, John, weren't we, with a few people yesterday, and they were saying, you know, how important his drawing board is. That's the, you know, his crucial tool, if you like. There's no record of this. It's not a digital element. So he's got his papers. The other element is obviously you're relying on self-policing and sort of whistleblowers. That's not going to happen if he's out of the loop, you know, and not in a factory. But I do mention factory, and this is the difficult thing with Adrian. He's still linked to the RB17 project at Red Bull, and that's the tricky element, I think, that's the minefield that they now have to walk through, to tiptoe through that, to find out how they can cut ties from that project, if indeed they are. I just don't see how he can keep both going and working at two different factories. So that is going to be intriguing over the next couple of months, how they, you know, go through that exit from that program.
And finally, then on this topic, what effect do we think this is going to have on Red Bull over the next few years? To your point there, Ben, but also especially I'm interested on Max Verstappen. I mean, for him to commit to stay with Red Bull Racing, he needs to believe that the team can thrive without Newey, without Jonathan Wheatley, the sporting director, who's been like the sergeant major, getting everything operationally flowing brilliantly over the years, with a Ford-badged engine that they're making themselves in Milton Keynes, without that sort of Honda input that they've had in the last few years. And that's not even to mention the bad blood that exists between his own father and Christian Horner, which clearly isn't going to get remedied anytime soon. I mean, what probability would you two put on Verstappen following Newey to Aston Martin Honda in 2026?
percentage? I mean, I think it's 50-50 at the moment, whether he stays or goes. It's faith is the word. Does he have faith, complete faith in Christian Horner and everything Christian Horner's telling him about what they've got in the pipeline? Is the engine going to be good? Are the technical team, you know, going to be sufficient to replace Adrian? That is really what Max needs to decide for himself. And I say himself because a lot of these decisions aren't being made by, well, I may take that back. I think he probably has final say, but it's, you know, by committee, isn't it? His dad, manager, and Max, they're the ones that come up with, you know, the career path and what he does. But ultimately, he's got to be sure as to himself what he wants to do. And it all comes down to faith and trust into what he's being told. If he doesn't believe what he's being told, then you can see him moving.
I think it's just come down to the competitiveness of the car. You can talk about, you know, structures and team people and who's there and who's not there in the future. I think it will be a cold, hard decision that if Red Bull continue giving him the car that can win races, he stays. If it looks like they're falling away and falling off the cliff, there are performance clauses in his contract. So if, you know, he stays through 25 into 26, and 26 is a, you know, disaster and Red Bull off the pace, he'll be gone for 27. I think it's as simple as that. Racing drivers sometimes, you know, for all the complications and all the deep analysis we do on the multiple factors that made them success, all they want is the fastest racing car. And that's mostly what they're motivated by.
Okay, well, let's move on then to our chat with David Richards. This month, his ProDrive company is celebrating 40 years at the top of motorsport. After success with Colin McRae in World Rally, Richards had a brief spell running the Benetton F1 team, but he really made his name in Formula One with the BAR Honda team and Jenson Button. 20 years ago this year, they beat everybody except the all-conquering Ferrari team of Michael Schumacher. For a comparison, Oliver Oakes is now attempting to do something a bit similar with the Alpine team. Well, Richards is also the most powerful man in UK racing as the chairman of Motorsport UK, the British arm of the FIA. And he was a kingmaker in the election of FIA President Mohammed Ben Sulayem 3 years ago. Hope you enjoy our chat. David, thank you so much for joining us. Great to see you. I mean, what does Formula One mean to you? Why, what's special about Formula One?
Well, you know, it's Formula One, whatever you say about it, it is the pinnacle of motorsport. And if you're involved in motorsport from a small boy onwards through your career, you somehow always aspire to being in Formula One at some point in your life.
You and I, our paths have crossed many times in the last 30 years, and particularly in Formula One. I was working with ITV commentating on when you were running the BAR Honda team. That was a team that was in a real mess when you joined, and then you got them going well to the point where Jenson Button, who you brought in, and the team finished second in the championship. He got a pole at Imola. What do you remember of those days?
That final year, when you inherit or take over an organization that's dysfunctional and you watch it mature, you watch it come together, and you see that sort of that camaraderie and that just the culture of the organization change, and then the results come as a result. It's extremely rewarding. In fact, for me, you know, people often say to me, you know, you've won world championships yourself in the rally, but, you know, what's the most rewarding thing you do? And it's actually building teams and putting a team together that somewhere, you know, that does achieves things as individuals you would never believe possible, but as a team, you can do it together.
Nigel Mansell once said to me, there's very few people who understand what it takes to win in Formula One. And it is a difficult formula. The people that find it, like Horner recently and Wolff and obviously Jean Todt, it can become a habit. But tell us a little bit from your perspective as someone who's had great success across the spectrum. What makes it so hard to win in Formula One?
Well, it's firstly, unless you've been there and done it, you don't realise the personal sacrifice and the commitment you have to make. This is not just a 9-to-5 job. It's not even a sort of, you know, 7-day-a-week job. It is absolutely all-encompassing. And today, with the number of races, of course, it wasn't that number of races in my time. It was slightly easier. But even so, I've often described it to people. I say to people, you know, come tell us what it's like. I say, well, if you really want to win in Formula One, it's a bit like being in medieval times, the Crusades. In February, you get on your horse, you ride off to the Middle East or wherever you went to on your Crusades, and you come back at the end of the year, and that would be it. And you would think of nothing else but doing that all that year. And that's what you've got to do. You live it, you breathe it, you think it every minute of your life for that that season. And if you're not doing that, somebody else is, and they're the ones that are going to beat you.
And that's more the case in F1 than it is, for example, in World Rally. I mean, you've won 3 World Rally Championships as a constructor and with drivers, but it's not as all-consuming then in rally. Or how is it different in F1?
I think it's just the focus of everybody there. You've got the top talents of engineering, driving, everything there, and it all comes to a sort of point in Formula One. Other sports, you know, I don't want to decry any of the other world championships, but they're not as intense as that. They're not as focused as they are, although they're becoming far more so. And I know that World Rally Championship now is far more intense than it ever was when I was competing.
Talk to me about managing drivers. I mentioned earlier on, you know, Jenson Button was someone you brought into the team who really got the BAR team sort of moving forward and got the results kind of coming through. And obviously he had his own particular way of driving and what have you. And you had Jacques Villeneuve, which was not necessarily such a harmonious relationship. But all these very different personalities, you know, famous names everybody's heard of. How do you manage them?
Well, you know, it's horses for courses. There's no one way of managing any individual, and it's relationships, and it's building up the relationship, the trust, more importantly. You know, I've seen drivers that sort of, you know, have come in to our team rather skeptical and rather sort of outsiders, if you like. And our job has been to, and I say our job because it's not just me, it's the whole team's got to embrace them and give them confidence and bring them into that our environment to get the best out of them. I would honestly say to you that I don't think there's a single driver in any of our teams that I've worked with over God knows how many years and how many drivers that I haven't had a fairly major falling out with at some point in time. Because, well, you know, quite frankly, being honest with drivers is another thing you have to be. You can't fiddle around the edges. If there's some complete mess, then they've got to be told and they've got to be held to account. They're part of a team.
And they don't like it, I imagine.
And they don't like it. And we've had mega fallings out. But I would also qualify that by saying that there is not a single driver that is employed by us over the years that I'm not a friend with now.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very telling. So you can go right across the red line with each other and come back. What understanding brings that together?
Well, I think in later life, you know, when you're a little bit older, you look back, you reflect on things. You know, did I behave appropriately at that time? Was David actually looking after my interests and the team interests as much as anything? And perhaps, you know, I should be been a bit more reasonable then. And you know, and you've got to accept these guys are sort of, they're putting under enormous pressure, you know, to deliver in a high intensity environment. So you've got to sympathize with that as well.
Now, another driver that you've had a lot to do with, who's a current one, is obviously Lewis Hamilton. What do you make of him as a personality, as a character and a driver?
Well, he is very complex. I wouldn't claim to know him particularly well these days. I remember Lewis when he was 8 years old, kart racing. I can actually visualize today the first time I saw him race at Buckmore Park, coming down the hill towards a hairpin, leading a little gaggle of cadet carts and already out in front. I wouldn't single out Lewis, but I'd single out any sportsman of this era, where to become successful, you have to focus virtually your entire life to the exclusion of everything else from a very early age. And that inevitably creates sort of tensions and issues for you personally. So you get to sort of your mid-20s and you sort of, all you've thought about is one thing, that's racing a car, and you inevitably push out at that point in time, and you want to sort of reach out and do things differently. And the great thing, I think, talking of Lewis, however, he has an opportunity to use his status, to use his achievements for great things now. And I see him doing that already, and I see far more potential for him to do that in the long term.
What do you think he's going to do then? What do you think the next 15, 20 years of Lewis Hamilton's going to be?
He's going to be an ambassador for for inclusion and for a whole wide range of issues which he feels passionately about and should feel passionately about. And he should be applauded for that and sort of supported in that as well.
So if we just wind it back slightly, your first taste as a team principal of Formula One was with Benetton in the late 1990s. You were there for a year. It was post Flavio Briatore's first time with the team, and before Rocco Benetton came in briefly. What was that experience like? What was it like at Benetton? And what did it leave you with? I mean, it was obviously a fairly short-lived thing. What did it leave you with in terms of an ambition?
It left me with the feeling I've got to do things differently the next time I get the opportunity. I went in just on my own. Knowing little about Formula One, to be quite frank with you. I thought I knew it all probably from my experience in rallying and circuit racing prior to then. And I was asked, could I mentor young Rocco and help him sort of take over the mantle there? Well, Rocco was a sort of, typical sort of early 20-year-old living in London, the high life, out at nightclubs most nights, and quite difficult to get to go to the office the next day, and delightful guy, but it was a challenge in itself. And I was thrown into an environment that was somewhat alien to me. I think the team probably were a bit sceptical about me and a bit sort of didn't have the immediate respect that some people enjoy when they go into those situations. So when I came away from that, I made a clear commitment to myself, when I go in next time, I'll do it with a team around me that I know, that I trust, that I can rely upon, and we'll go with a plan.
So that's what you did, of course, when you were called in 2002, beginning of 2002. Yep. End of 01, you started at the beginning of 02 with ProDrive, the company that you've built that's been running for 40 years now, engineering excellence at the heart of Banbury. And you came in there, and Honda was obviously part of the equation there. They eventually ended up buying the team after you'd finished that contract. But what was it like working with Honda? And because they've been through many different iterations in the Formula One years.
It was quite challenging with Honda in those days, because the fundamental, of course, is when you have a separation of the two groups, you have the chassis team based here in Brackley, and then you have an engine department that's Japanese. Each of them have their own sort of priorities, but that doesn't work. You could have the best engine in the world and the best chassis in the world, but if they don't fit together properly, you're not going to win a thing. And so that was our challenge. When I went over to Japan on a couple of occasions to speak to them, I said, look, we have to look at things slightly differently here. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, well, we've got the best engine in Formula One. We've got 1,000 horsepower. That's what we promised our president. And that's what we've done. I said, but the engine's heavy, it's big, and it drinks fuel. And if you made some compromises there and we worked on the chassis together, we could make something extraordinary. And the cultural divide and making that happen was quite challenging. And keeping the team motivated, knowing that with these challenges, was quite an issue.
Yeah, I mean, they used to listen to Ayrton Senna when he told them to do things. But I guess the challenge with Honda has always been communication, hasn't it? I mean, the most recent time with McLaren, it was all complete breakdown in communication.
Yeah, it's so often the case. But there's big cultural divides, across the, Japanese to English. We behave differently, we think differently. And although perhaps on reflection, looking back now with my experience with the Japanese, with Subaru and other nationalities more recently, I'm becoming a little more what's the word I'm looking for? It's maybe our understanding of other people's cultures and the way they behave. And I think one of the most fundamental things that I see and I always tell people is that if you're speaking in English from a foreign language, you tend to speak in black and white. You don't have the nuances in between that we use that somehow soften the message. It's either yes or no. And sometimes that can come over a bit abruptly.
So the BAR thing obviously had a lot of success, gave you a real taste for Formula One. And then you wanted to enter in your own right with ProDrive. A couple of goes at that. The first time was something you were cooking up with Max Mosley, Customer Cars, McLaren, Mercedes. Tell us a little bit about that episode.
Well, I look back now and you talk about the politics of Formula One today. We were right in the hub of it at that time. It was the time when Max was really trying to seize control of Formula One from the other manufacturers who were looking to break away. And it was, I did rather get myself in the middle of it all. And the idea was that a change of Concord agreement was going to effectively take away the necessity to build your own car, the IP in your own car, which was has been in Concord agreement or previous years for many years. And we looked at this and thought, this is an opportunity, and it's what everyone knows as today as sort of customer cars, and become rather common in some areas now. But then it was a bit of a somewhat novel concept. And I remember having a meeting with Bernie, and Bernie said, great idea. You'll get the cars from last year, save the money, and you'll be reasonably good, and you'll certainly might not be at the back of the grid. I said, well, that's not quite the idea, Bernie. I've actually got an agreement to get the current car and the current engine, and I'll just do young drivers and, you know, all sorts of ideas around that. And he said, oh, well, that's going to cause a few problems for people, I think. And with that, when Williams found out, lo and behold, there's letters flying, lawyers flying everywhere. And unbeknown to me, Max had already agreed with Frank Williams a letter that said that, you know, the new Concord agreement would very much be in the form, same form as the previous one, which was interpreted as no customer cars. And it went on and on, backwards and forwards. And it got to a point where by October that year, it wasn't going to be possible to be ready for the following year. And Martin Whitmarsh was very supportive at McLaren. And but it unfortunately, that great idea never came to fruition.
So Williams got one over on you at that occasion, but you'd got one over on him a few years earlier. Well, I think Jenson Button and the driver contract. Is that the way it works? Is it all sort of big egos bashing into each other and who wins and who loses?
I suspect that's very much the case. I hope that I don't fall into that category and I'm sort of more objective about these things. But that's a lot of what Formula One's about. And but then we had another go. A couple of years later, we sort of put our name forward. But again, I wasn't prepared to compromise. We had an agreement then that Mercedes would supply us with the engine. And I was told the night before the submissions or the final decision, if you don't have a Cosworth engine, you ain't going to get a place. And we weren't prepared to compromise because I didn't think that was going to be successful. And I think reflecting backwards on that and looking at the demise of both teams that sort of came to into Formula One at that time, then I think that was true.
Let's bring it up to present day then, David. Liberty Media have owned Formula One since 2017. I think when they came in, a lot of people have been aware of Bernie Ecclestone's way of running Formula One for many, many decades. And some were a bit sceptical, but if you go to Grand Prix now, I mean, it's people are fighting each other to get a ticket. They're sold out. The numbers are growing and growing. The revenue pouring into the sport is amazing. What do you make of it?
They've done a superb job. It's a very American style. It's very different from the way that the exclusive network that Bernie wanted to foster and did successfully. And, you know, let's not beat about the bush. Bernie did a sensational job to get Formula One to where it was and handed over in very good order. But there was a lot of low-hanging fruit that we've seen subsequent to that. And Liberty have just done a sensational job with it. And obviously helped by Netflix videos and behind the scenes and all the different characters in the sport that still prevail today.
I did an interview with Renee Wilm for this podcast, the number two at Liberty Media, CEO of Las Vegas Grand Prix. And she said that they're only just scratching the surface as far as the United States is concerned. What do you think about here in Europe, UK, the rest of the world? Do you think Formula One can continue to grow?
Well, it depends on what you define as growth. You know, Formula One is a very important business to the UK. We, most of the teams based here, the level of employment here, not just the teams themselves, but the spin-off, all the supporting industry around it is very substantial and recognized to a certain extent, but in my view, not to the extent it should be recognized by government and in terms of the revenue we bring into the UK and the profile it brings to the UK for our engineering and technology services. So it's and with my Motorsport UK hat on, I'm banging the drum at every opportunity I can on that count.
What more would you like from the government then?
I just want recognition. It's like everything in life. You know, you take your children, recognition drives achievement. And all I ask the government to do, not, looking for handouts or anything like that, just give us the recognition, give us the profile to put our name forward, use Formula One as a technology platform when you go and promote British industry to the Chinese or across the other side of the world to the Americans. Because we are an industry and a group of people above all other aspects of UK technology and stand out above them.
What's the number you use in terms of how much it contributes to the UK economy?
I don't know the numbers. I can't reflect on the numbers myself, but it's substantial.
Billions.
Oh, it's billions. It's very, very much so.
And tens of thousands of people employed.
A number of people employed. And they talk of 40,000 people employed in the industry across the board. But of course, it's not just Formula One. It's world rallying. It's sports car racing. We've lost some of the junior formula to some of our continental competitors. But hopefully there's an opportunity for that to come back in the future.
And the British Grand Prix last year, 480,000 people over 4 days, the biggest ever attendance at a Formula One race. Remarkable. And again, the contract is in place for the long term. What's your read on the health of Formula One in Great Britain and the British Grand Prix?
Well, it's really encouraging to see another 10 years of Formula One come to Silverstone, and it allows for proper investment in the infrastructure at Silverstone. A lot of it is dependent, of course, on the success of British drivers. And so whilst we've got British drivers at the forefront of Formula One, that'll also draw the attendance and audience to Silverstone. So we've got to encourage that and make sure the junior formulas are supported properly. And our role at Motorsport UK is not about Formula One. It's not about the sort of Touring Car Championship or World Sports Cars. They look after themselves. It's not our job to interfere with those commercial arrangements. What we should be doing is concentrating on the grassroots, building that pyramid, if you like. So the opportunity for anyone from an eight-year-old carter through to sort of someone living in an inner city who only dreams about motor racing has that opportunity to get into a kart in an indoor karting circuit and could live the dream, could be another Lewis Hamilton. So that's what we've got to be doing.
So thank you very much, David. It's lovely to see you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Delighted.
John, interesting to hear David's thoughts there on how hard it is to build a winning culture, on our theme of there's no guarantees of success in Formula One that we're chatting about today. But I mean, he's succeeded everywhere, but only partial success in F1. Maybe a case of wrong place, wrong time?
Yeah, I think it's to do with the difficulties of winning in Formula One, because you're almost beholden on, there are certain factors in your control that you can do. You can hire the best drivers and have the best facilities and hire the best staff possible. But equally, you are reliant on decisions made by other people have an influence on how successful that can be, for example, which can relate to new car regulations, new engine regulations, or other aspects. And one thing, DR talked about quite interestingly was that period of Pro Drive's own potential entry into Formula One. This is at a time of Mosley versus the manufacturers in Formula One and potential customer teams. And then David talked there about the Mercedes customer plan, which fell through because he was told he needs a Cosworth engine. So he was reliant there. And if the decisions from above had been different, if he'd been given the green light for a Mercedes, customer team at that time, who knows how successful that could have been? Because we see, the McLaren team these days is a Mercedes customer team fighting for the world championship. So it seemed a pretty fair route. If you had a Mercedes customer engine deal over the past decade in Formula One, I think you've been pretty well set to deliver a fair degree of success.
Also interesting, Ben, was to hear him be so honest that he fell out with pretty much all the drivers he worked with during his time with them. I mean, Do you think that is more common than we imagine from the outside?
Yeah, I would actually. I'd imagine that's probably the case. You can't be everyone's friend, can you? I think you've got to make ruthless decisions. We mentioned before Lawrence Stroll being forced to make that decision, maybe about his own son. So, yes, I can imagine him full well falling out with everyone. And of course, yeah, what a wonderful achievement. You know, 40 years, incredible. I think back to my first time working in Formula One. I was doing some media, it was market research, media market research for the BAR Honda team, and just reading articles in lots of different languages and doing my best to understand the Japanese at the time. But record all these mentions of BAR Honda, Dave Richards, Jensen, Anthony Davidson, and you know, it's amazing to think that you know, he's still going in that, you know, the role that he's in at the moment for Motorsport UK and doing such a great job. I just wish he was the FIA president personally.
Well, that brings us to my final question, actually, John. I mean, let's just talk about Richards's role. He was the kingmaker, really, in the last FIA presidential election a couple of years ago. He backed Mohammed Ben Sulayem against a British candidate, Graham Stoker, who had been Jean Todt's deputy throughout Todt's reign as FIA president. Do you think Richards should have gone for the job himself?
I think DR is the sort of person who, at this stage of life, would only commit to something, I think, if he felt he could, in the words of Newey, go all in. So he'd want to give it 100% and do it to the max. And I don't think he probably felt that he was wanted to or was in the position to give that FIA job, because it is a tough job and there's a lot to do. And the FIA, you know, is going through a, you know, sometimes some confrontational stuff with FOM. Sometimes, you know, the structures need to evolve and it needs to modernize. And I think he, you know, while I think he would make a great FI president, he probably felt himself that not the right time, not the right circumstance. And as we go back, you know, you reflect on his career, same as the, you know, ProDrive Mercedes or ProDrive customer team. Life sometimes is about, you know, when you're ready to do things, sometimes the world isn't ready for you to do it, unfortunately. And sometimes in life, you know, Adrian Newey's ready to join Aston Martin and you've got a team ready for him and then potentially it all works.
Well, that's a perfect place to end our discussion. Absolutely fascinating. And just all going to prove that there is no such thing as a guarantee of success in Formula One. But we're certainly going to be watching the progress of Newey and Aston Martin with great interest. My thanks then to David Richards, to Ben Hunt and John Noble. Check out all of Ben and John's latest F1 news stories and features on Autosport online or via the app. Send us your questions or comments to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X or email us on JamesAllenOnF1@motorsport.com. And make sure to check out all the behind-the-scenes F1 stories on Autosport and follow the podcast this Azerbaijan Grand Prix weekend. Thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production, and thanks to you for listening. Please do click to follow or subscribe and leave us a review and a rating and tell all your F1 mad friends all about us. We love seeing new listeners discovering the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.